that he was born blind. And I know we read this and we kind of chuckle and we think, what a silly question. You think the guy sinned in his mother's womb that he'd be born blind? But the Jews in general, when they would see a person like this, they figured somebody had to do something wrong. And he must be suffering some kind of punishment from God. There is some kind of connection between suffering and sin. And that's true generically. There is a connection between suffering and sin. I mean, all the suffering that exists in this world is ultimately the consequence of sin. And it's also true that people can suffer specifically themselves for some kind of punishment for some sin that they have committed. We see examples of that in the Bible. You remember Miriam when she spoke against Moses and God punishes her. Or Ananias and Sapphira, when they lie before their brethren and misrepresent how generous they really are and God strikes them dead. Or even the Christians in Corinth who were abusing the Lord's Supper and some of them had died because of their behavior. On the other hand, we also know that there are people who suffer not because of a single thing that they've done wrong. And who do we typically point to when we say, here's an example of a man who suffered tremendously. He didn't do a thing wrong. Job is I expected two things. One would be Job, and the other one is Jesus, right? Two examples of people in the Bible. I mean, we could think of many more. You think of Paul with his, you know, thorn in the flesh, or you think of Joseph and the suffering he endured in Egypt. Well, the disciples are assuming this man must be blind because somebody did something wrong. Now, this is an important detail that John is kind of setting the stage with at the beginning of the story, because it reflects just the attitude of the Jews in general, not just Jesus' disciples, but even the Jewish leadership that we're going to see in this story. And Jesus is going to correct them and say, no, this is not the problem. But that's how people thought about this man. They thought either he's a sinner or his parents are a sinner. Somebody's a sinner because he's a blind man. And Jesus says, no, you're wrong about that. Jesus answered, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. It's totally different than what you expect. It's that God could be glorified. It's that some good could come out of this so that other people could see God's greatness. God is going to use this man's condition as an illustration of what we are like. And then he's going to heal this man to teach us just how powerful he is in his ability to change us. Blindness is a fitting symbol for sin, a fitting symbol for a life that is dominated by sin. Now, the man is not blind because he sinned, but being blind is a figure for what it is like to live in sin apart from God. When you walk in the dark, you can't see the way that you're going. You wind up hurting yourself and hurting other people. And that's exactly what happens when you live in the darkness of sin. You wind up hurting yourself, you wind up hurting other people, and you wind up hurting, most important of all, God. And this is just like we saw with the healing of the lame man. Lameness is also a fitting symbol of sin and our brokenness and our need for being restored. And so it's the same kind of idea happening once again in this object lesson that Jesus is going to play out here. And so Jesus tells them, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. And again, you realize Jesus is being rather profound here. He's not, he's saying something here. Night is coming. He's going to die soon. He's not going to be with them in the way things are right now. And he says, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Jesus alone is the real light. He is alone the one who can actually give people sight. So having said these things, and this is one of the most curious things, having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sin. Now, you know how this story goes. This is a familiar story. You know he's going to go and wash and he's going to receive his sight. But why does Jesus heal the man this way? This is the first time in the Gospel of John when Jesus heals a person and he's using his hands to do something. Every other instance where he's healing somebody, what have we seen? What does he do? He just speaks. By the mere power of His Word, He is able to instantaneously restore a person. He will tell a father of a little boy who's miles and miles away, go, your son will live. Or He'll tell a lame man at the Pool of Bethesda, you know, get up and walk. And He does. Here, Jesus actually stops and He spits on the ground and He uses His hands and He puts it on His face and does all this. Well, why does He do that? Obviously, it's not because He needed to do that. John has already established the fact that Jesus is more than capable enough of just speaking a word and completely taking care of a problem. No, He's doing this on purpose. There's a reason behind it. Now, the early church fathers saw a connection here with Genesis and the creation, and I think they're probably right about that. Genesis chapter 2, you remember the Lord God formed the man of the dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living creature. And so when the Bible tells us about how God made us in the very beginning, it says that God actually formed us. We are His handiwork. And Job kind of refers to this, your hands fashioned and made me. And now you've destroyed me altogether. Remember that you've made me like clay, and will you return me to the dust? And additionally, Nathan had shared with me an article Rusty Taylor wrote. If you heard his lecture in the, I think it was the most recent Florida College lectureship, yeah, or get that book, he has just an excellent lecture on this very passage in John chapter 9. And he makes a point in there that if you read from the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are writings that associate spit, as weird and strange as it sounds to us, that associate spit with the creation of Adam from the dust. So both with what we have in the Old Testament and from extra-biblical writings, there could clearly have been some kind of connection in the Jewish mind between this, you know, spitting on the ground, forming the dust. It recalls what God did in creation in the beginning. Jesus is performing a creative act here. John is depicting Jesus as the creator, as the divine creator who is the only one who is able to take a man who was born with eyes that didn't work and give him eyes that do work. Only God can do something like that. But now there's something else here that's going on that's really, really important for this narrative. This serves a really important function, a couple of important functions in the narrative. First of all, you notice that Jesus is preventing the man from actually seeing Jesus' own face. The man has only heard Jesus' voice. He hasn't actually seen Jesus' face. And the way Jesus goes about healing him, he is ensuring that the man does not get to see Jesus face to face when he finally gets to open his eyes for the first time. Because he's going to be walking down the street and going down to the pool, and Jesus is not going to be there. Second, it introduces a potential problem, a problem in this narrative, and it's a Sabbath problem. Jesus has made this mud with his hands. Now, John hasn't told us it's the Sabbath yet. He's kind of holding back. He's going to drop that detail in a minute. But he's setting us up for that here, that Jesus has made this mud. So he tells him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. Now, I want you to notice before we go any further, this man did not ask Jesus for a thing. The initiative in this entire account all lies with Jesus. Jesus chose to do this. Jesus acts, and the man is just sitting there very passively, hasn't done anything, hasn't asked for anything. And this is very similar and reminds us of the lame man at the Pool of Bethesda. And in fact, I think John expects us to compare this healing here with what happened back in chapter 5 with the lame man. You think about both of those stories, there are many, many similarities. In both of them, Jesus takes the initiative. In both of them, the man does not ask to be healed. In both of them, there is some kind of discussion about sin. With the lame man, Jesus tells him, sin no more, right? That nothing worse would happen to you. And in this case, there's this kind of preceding discussion about, oh, who sinned? You know, this man or his parents. In both of these accounts, the authorities are angry with Jesus because he healed on the Sabbath, because he's done something on the Sabbath. He's done something on the Sabbath he shouldn't have done, either that he healed or that he asked a man to carry his pallet or that he has made mud with his hands. In both of these accounts, the authorities interrogate the man who was healed as kind of a proxy to get to Jesus. But there's a really big difference, I think, between these two accounts. And we talked about it. I've already told you this. But there's a really big difference between the two, and it's the way the man who was healed responds to Jesus. There's no evidence that the lame man ever really responded in trust to Jesus. In fact, he seems to very cowardly take the side of the authority. Oh, don't blame me. I didn't do anything. You know, he shows no real loyalty to Jesus, no courage in the face of his opponents who hate him and want to kill him. That's going to be different today. This man is one of the most loyal and courageous and faithful people to Jesus that you read about in the Gospel of John. And it's just a wonderful story. So he went and washed and came back seeing. And this is just a very typical, understated telling of a miracle that you read in the Gospel of John, or any of the Gospels for that matter. Once again, Jesus hasn't made a scene. He hasn't drawn attention to himself. John doesn't embellish the story with all kinds of extraneous detail that you didn't know. Nothing like that. It's just the man did what Jesus said, and he was made well. The end. It's that simple. You wash like Jesus says to wash, and Jesus heals you. And I'm sure you can see the lesson behind that. Now, imagine being this man, though. Imagine that you were in his shoes. I wonder, I imagine, he probably heard the conversation going on with Jesus and the disciples. Maybe not. I don't know. We're not told. But maybe he's sitting there, I imagine, probably close to the temple as a beggar, looking for alms. And imagine you're just sitting there in complete blindness one day, and you start hearing this conversation. Hey, who sinned, that guy or his parents? Oh, great. You know, you're going to be talked about by the local people theorizing. And then you have this stranger come up to you, whether he heard that conversation or not. This stranger comes up to you, and he starts putting this stuff on your eyes, and you just feel him rubbing his fingers on your eyes. It's like spit and mud. And now, how would you respond to that? I do not know why, but there's something about this man led him to think, I need to do what this stranger is telling me to do. I don't know if he thought at this point in the story, well, I might as well give it a try, or if he had some kind of inkling of, you know, that guy came to my defense in face of these people who asked if I was a sinner or my parents were a sinner. I don't know. But for whatever reason, he does what Jesus says, and he comes back seeing. He didn't challenge Jesus. He didn't question. I mean, you could imagine many people in this situation who have said, who are you? What are you doing touching my face? You know, leave me alone. But there's no challenging, no questioning. He just obeys Jesus. And Jesus gives him sight, because he trusted him. Go wash in the pool of Siloam, Jesus had said, which means sent. The pool of Siloam is, so here's a kind of an artist's picture of Jerusalem. This is, of course, the Temple Mount, and you can see all the houses down here at the bottom of the picture. And you see there's kind of like a roadway here from the temple that would lead you down to this pool at the very bottom of the picture, and that's where we now know the Pool of Siloam, we believe, was located. There's kind of a closer picture. It would have been, I mean, Jerusalem had, you know, a bunch of these kind of pools, but this was one of them. And I think this was discovered in 2004 when they were installing a sewer pipe in Jerusalem. This kind of stuff happens all the time. They'll be working in the city and, oh, stop what you're doing. We just found something really important. Savannah can probably tell you more about that. But here's kind of a mural they put up just kind of depicting, well, this is what it would have looked like, something like this. And you've got all these big steps, and you can just, you know, step down into the water, fully immerse yourself, and come back up. So, you know, with things like this in the city of Jerusalem, you can understand how, in, for example, in Acts chapter 2, when all these, you know, thousands of people are coming to Jesus and they're being baptized, it wasn't a problem to accomplish something that in a city with these kind of facilities. But anyway, so go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. John calls out that detail to us, the meaning of the name Siloam, that it means sent. Well, Jesus is going to step away now and be absent for almost the rest of this story. In a broader context, if we would take the time and read like chapter 7 through 10, you're going to see over and over, Jesus keeps talking about how he is sent from God. And there's all this discussion about, where is Jesus from? We don't know where he's from. Well, I'm from my Father. You don't know where I'm from. I'm sent from God. I and the Father are one. And so Jesus is uniquely sent by God, the light, into the dark world to bring light to our darkness. And just as God has sent Jesus to us, so Jesus now sends this man in ways that the man doesn't even realize yet. And this man is going to testify the truth of Jesus to the Pharisees, to the authorities. And so we are meant in some way to see him as Jesus' representative as we continue going through this story. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Isn't this the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "Yeah, that's him. It's he." Others said, "No, but he's like him. I'll grant you, he looks like him, but that's not the same guy. That's a different guy." He kept saying, "I am the man. It's me." Now, blind people in this time, in this culture, they could really only survive by begging. And so begging near or in the temple would have been really common. It's a large area. You got a lot of people there. You got a lot of religious people who had been commanded to help the poor. And so people recognize the man in some sense, but they've never seen him like this. In fact, he is so different, they're not really sure it's even him. That's just how completely Jesus has changed the man. And the same ought to be said about all of Jesus' disciples, that we're so changed that we're not who we were before. And he kept saying, "I am the man." Now, you remember last time we noticed when Jesus was walking on the water and he wanted to tell him, "Hey, don't be afraid," he said, "It's me," right? And what was the original wording there in the Greek? He actually said, "I am." And we talked about how significant that was, especially in the Gospel of John, where you have all these "I am" sayings, and Jesus is shown to be the great "I am." Well, the same words show up here where this man says, "I am." Now, he's not claiming to be God or any such thing. That's not the point. But when you hear him say those same words that you heard Jesus say over and over, then I think John is telling the story in such a way that invites us to realize that this man has been sent as a sort of representative for Jesus to speak to the Jews. So they said to him, "Well, then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me," he anointed my, did you catch that? He's anointing, he has an anointing from Jesus. "And he said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I don't know." Now, why do you think they're asking this question? "Oh, where is he? We can't wait to find him. This is just such a great and wonderful thing that he's done for you. We're just so happy and thrilled for you. We can't wait to meet." No. You know, it'd be great if they had a reaction like the Samaritans. "We want to go see Jesus ourselves." But that's sadly not the case. Instead, they are opposed to Jesus. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. And now there's going to be a big interrogation. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. And this is just like back in chapter 5 with the lame man. John has saved this detail for right now. And we realize, okay, the confrontation's going to begin. Now, we all know the purpose of the Sabbath was so, one, you could have rest from your regular work and focus on your relationship with God. We also know, as Tom has pointed out repeatedly, the purpose of the Sabbath was not just so that you could rest, but it was specifically that you were delivered out of bondage and into rest with God. And you can see just how appropriate it is that this man have this kind of deliverance from his bondage of blindness on the Sabbath. And it's right. It is the best day for him to be healed in this way. Now, when you think about what Jesus did with his hands and making the mud, that hardly seems to us like work, but the Jews had 39 laws for things that you could not do on the Sabbath, and one of them was you could not knead. You were not allowed to knead, according to their traditions. And John emphasizes repeatedly in this story that Jesus made the mud. You see that in verse 14? He made the mud and opened his eyes. And the Pharisees are surely going to take issue with this. Now, there are two problems that the Pharisees have. First, their understanding of the Sabbath is wrong. The law of Moses did not condemn anything that Jesus did, but the Jews, in their zeal to respect God's authority, in their zeal to make sure they don't go beyond what God has said, had added these things, these restrictions that God had not commanded, and ironically, they went beyond what God had said and missed the point of the Sabbath altogether. But it's not just their understanding of the Sabbath that's wrong, it's their understanding of Jesus that's wrong. He is not a mere man. He is God. And he has every right to do whatever he wants to do on the Sabbath because, after all, he's God. And he's made that point before. We've seen Jesus make that point before. Frankly, the problem with the Pharisees is that they were not interested in really knowing God. They were interested in being the authority. They were interested in saying, we've got this figured out. We're the ones in charge. We know who God is, and we can explain him to you. But they weren't interested in having somebody explain anything to them. And so because they didn't really want to know God, they didn't really know the Sabbath, and they didn't really know Jesus. And so as you go on, the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, he put mud on my eyes, and I washed, and I see. You see this pattern developing where they just keep asking him the same question. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. We know what's okay on the Sabbath, and this guy is doing something that's not okay on the Sabbath. He made mud, that's not okay, he can't be from God. The end of the story. But others said, yeah, but how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? I mean, if the guy's eyes used to be blind and now he can see, maybe at least some of them, it appears, at least some of them are open to the idea that maybe our understanding of the Sabbath breaking is wrong. But you got to make a choice. You either say, my understanding of this is wrong, and I have to change, or you say, nope, he's a sinner. Now, I don't know what to do about that, you know, the sign that's occurred, but I know he's a sinner. And there was a division among them, and the light has come, and now you have this dual response. Some people are maybe entertaining coming to the light, and many others are saying, no, I don't want to have any part of this light. So they again said to the blind man, what do you say about him since he's opened your eyes? He said, he's a prophet. Now, he doesn't fully understand Jesus' identity or everything about Jesus yet, but he at least knows this much. He has to be from God because he gave me sight, right? The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight. Maybe this never happened. Maybe he actually never was blind. Maybe this is all just a big hoax. Just deny the facts. This was all made up, right? They didn't believe it until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and they asked him, is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? His parents answered, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees, we don't know. Nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He is of age. He'll speak for himself. Now, to give legal testimony, you had to be at least 13 years old. So that probably indicates this guy's a fairly young man if they're going to say something like, he's of age. And also, both his mom and his dad are alive, so he's probably a fairly young man. The courage he kind of shows later in the story kind of fits in with somebody who'd be of a fairly young age. But they don't want to have anything to do with this. They don't ask us. You just go talk to him about this. Now, you would think that if your son, who has lived all these years in utter blindness, suddenly had his eyes opened one day, that you'd have some appreciation for the man who had done this for your own son. You would think that you say, this is one, we are so happy for you, son, and we are so thankful to this man who's done this. But that's not what happens. John says his parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue, disfellowshipped, shunned, put away. You can't come to church anymore. You can't come to synagogue anymore. You're no longer one of us. We're not going to eat with you. We're not going to have anything to do with you. And the man gets no support from his parents because they are more concerned with being accepted at synagogue than they are with their own son. Now that's ironic to me, and it's sad, because how much love did the Pharisees have for these parents? They don't love them at all. The Pharisees don't love the man, they don't love his parents, and they're choosing to stay with a group of people who do not actually love them. We know that later on in the story, they're going to accuse the man and say, "You were born in utter sin." Whether they're accusing him of that or his parents, it doesn't matter. They show no love to any of them. It's bad enough the teachers are against this man, and now even his parents are against him. So for the second time, they call the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give glory to God. We know this man is a sinner." And when they say here, "Give glory to God," this is in the sense of Joshua speaking to Achan when he was guilty. "Fess up, man. You know that this man's a sinner. You go ahead and fess up and tell the truth. You know he's a sinner. You tell us the truth. He's a sinner, isn't he?" Well, he is going to give glory to God, but not in the way that they're expecting. This man is going to courageously side with Jesus. And he answered, "Whether he's a sinner, I don't know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." And these kinds of things happen over and over in the Gospel of John, where some statement just jumps off the page at you and you say, that is something that every single one of us as Jesus' disciples ought to be able to say. "One thing I know, I was blind, but now I see." I mean, we have hymns that speak in this very way. And every one of us ought to be able to freely and gladly speak in that way. They said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" And this is just like the rest of the gospel where they keep coming to Jesus over, "Are you really the Christ?" And Jesus, "I've told you, you don't want to listen. You keep coming and asking the same stuff." And they're doing the same thing here to this blind man. And he answered them, "I've told you already, and you wouldn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" That is just hilarious. I mean, he is just humiliating them. This is just like when you see Jesus in the temple, and they're asking him questions, and now he turns the tables on them. And these lessons that Nathan has been going through with us, where you see people come in to attack Jesus, and before it's all over, they're actually on the run because he's completely turned the tables on them. And that's what's happening here in this scenario. And they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." "We are disciples of Moses," they say. No, they're really not. Because if they had been, they would have listened to Jesus. "We don't know where he comes from." That's right. They don't. They don't recognize where he's from. And the man answered, "Why? This is an amazing thing. You don't know where he comes from. And yet he opened my eyes. We know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." Now at this point, who's really on trial? Jesus or the Pharisees? Now they're on trial, right? They're the ones who are guilty of sin. They're the ones who are guilty of rejecting Jesus. And this point that he makes is very significant. You can search the Old Testament. You will not find an example of someone who was born blind and then healed. You won't find an example of that even in the traditional Jewish writings. And yet you open up the prophets like Isaiah, and they say, when the Messiah comes, among the things you will see are the blind having their sight being given to them. And this man, born blind, being given sight, is a significant sign that God is at work among them. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And they bristle at this. They cannot stand that this man would dare to tell them that they are wrong, that they need correcting. And they answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and would you teach us?" And they cast him out of the synagogue. "Don't come back. You're not part of us anymore. You're not allowed to worship or be part of our group." You were born in utter sin. So the man was blind after all. In their anger, in their defense of their self, in their arrogance, they admit and confess that this man was born blind and he now sees. And they still have not reconciled that fact. They admit that he's been healed. But you see, they're angry and they don't care. In their anger, all they want to do is defend themselves. And that's what happens when you have that arrogance and self-defense, and it leads you to say things and do things that don't make sense. Jesus' actions have challenged their own understanding of what it means to keep the Sabbath, their own understanding of what it means to be right with God, and they cannot stand the idea that they would be wrong about that. And they're so convinced that they're correct that they wind up rejecting God himself. And so they answered him in this way, and they cast him out. So this interrogation has backfired, and you know, Jesus and John the Baptist talked about this kind of thing happening earlier in the gospel. I'm going to pass over that for the sake of time. But Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and he comes and finds the man. And there's something very touching to me about that. Jesus knows now that this man has been rejected by the authorities. He has been rejected even by his own parents. He has been cast out, never to be. You think, for what? What did he do that was wrong? What sin did he commit except that he sided with the man who opened his eyes and gave him sight? And now he's cast out by everybody. And I heard Shane Scott preaching on this text once, and he pointed out, and I just think this is so touching, he says it reminds him of Psalm 27, which says, "For my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me in." And boy, that is who God is. You might be rejected by everybody because you choose to side with Jesus. Your own parents might reject you because you choose to side with Jesus. Your Christian brothers and sisters who you go to church with might give you grief because you choose to side with Jesus on something. And we need to remember that when that happens, Jesus does not forsake us. He seeks us and takes us in. That's who God is. Jesus heard that they'd cast him out, and having found him, he said to him, "Do you trust in the Son of Man?" Now, this is not, "Do you believe that I exist?" And this is not even, "Do you believe that I am who I say I am?" But, "Do you put your trust in me completely? Do you put your confidence in me?" And he answered him, "And who is he, sir, that I may trust in him?" And we've talked before about how sir and Lord, it's the same word, and just depending on the context, it'll be translated one way or the other. And he's very much like the woman at the well at this point, where he's just being polite. You know, "Who is he, sir, that I may trust in him?" You remember, he hasn't actually seen Jesus' face yet. This is the first time he's actually seeing Jesus' physical face. And Jesus says, "Well, do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Well, who is he, sir, that I should believe him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him. You have seen him. And it is he who is speaking to you." And this sounds just like Jesus' answer to the Samaritan woman. "I who speak to you am the Christ," right? "You have seen him," which is profound. Jesus is not just saying, "Well, you're looking at him. This is my face." That's not his point. He's saying, "You've already seen me. You've seen me more accurately and more truly than any of these opponents who have seen me, because you realize that I am from God." And we know, you see just how accurately he sees Jesus by what he does in the next verse. He said, not just sir, I mean, it's the same word, but it carries a totally different meaning now, where he says, "Lord, I trust." And he worshiped him. And that's what Jesus is looking for. That's the confidence that Jesus wants out of each of us, that we would fully and completely trust him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." And someone might say, "Well, wait a second, I thought that, you know, earlier in the Gospel of John, it said something different, that God didn't send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world. Isn't that true?" Well, yes, that's true. Jesus didn't come just to condemn us all. Jesus came to save us. But you see, when Jesus comes to save us, he is the light coming into the darkness to open the eyes of people who are blind. To put it rather simply, Jesus has come to tell us we're wrong. And that's not easy to hear. And when the light comes to you and says, "You're in the dark," yeah, to come to the light, you have to admit it. You have to say, "Yeah, I'm wrong. I need a change." And there are going to be a lot of people who just don't want to do that. And so for that reason, they are judged. And Jesus says that, "I came for judgment." He came to save, but it's going to result in judgment for a lot of people. That those who do not see may see, people like this blind man. And those who see, people like the Pharisees, people who think, "I've got this all figured out. I don't need any help. I'm trusting in myself." Well, they'll become blind, and that's exactly what happened to them. Now, some of the Pharisees standing near heard him say these things and said to him, and this is just amazing, they said to him, "Are we also blind? Jesus, are you accusing us of being blind?" And I think they're just completely self-absorbed at this point. It reminds me of Proverbs, which says, you know, "Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for him." Jesus said to them, if you were blind, if you could just admit, I think, that you were blind, you would have no guilt. You could find forgiveness. You could find me and be forgiven. But now that you say, see, Jesus knows, they still think, "Yeah, we're not blind. We can see just fine. We don't need you, Jesus." But now that you say we see, your guilt remains. And the first step in Jesus being able to forgive us and change us is us being willing to admit that we need his help. Now, so I just want to end with 2 points. First, that Jesus has come to change us. Whether you grew up in a religious home or not, whether you grew up in the church, as they might say, or not, it doesn't matter. Every single one of us have to come to some point in our life where we can genuinely and freely and gladly say, "I was blind. Ah, but now in Jesus, I see." And so Jesus has come to change us. And so we need to be seeking him as the light. We need to realize that he's what I need to come to. And part of that fundamentally, really, is that choice in what am I putting my ultimate confidence in? Is my confidence in myself and my obedience and what I've done? Or is my confidence in Jesus? That fundamental decision is critical, amazingly, if you want to live a life of obedience, as we all should. That fundamental decision of putting my confidence outside of myself and into the one and only place that confidence can and should truly be put, into my Creator, into Jesus himself, the one who is truly light, and there is no darkness at all. Until I do that, then any kind of obedience I attempt is going to be far from what it needs to be. And then the second thing is that Jesus sends us out. Now that we've had our eyes open, now that we've been changed, now that we realize the whole problem is me putting that confidence in myself and not putting it elsewhere in Jesus, living for myself instead of living for Jesus, being resistant to saying, "You know, I was wrong and I need to change." Like this man, Jesus sends us out into the darkness, into a dark world. And the reception is not always going to be welcome. We might receive opposition from our family or our neighbors or our coworkers or even people that we consider brothers and sisters in Christ because of some circumstance that arises. Now, I'm not saying that because of anything. Obviously, there's nothing I know of in this congregation I appreciate so much the relationship we all have. But there's a strong lesson for us to remember as we go throughout our life. There's so many examples in this story of people we should not be like. Don't be like the neighbors who just follow whatever the religious authorities say. Oh, let's just take this man to the Pharisees and see what they say. We'll let them decide this, and whatever they decide, that's what we're going to do. Don't be like the parents who just say, you know what, I just don't want to upset anybody. I just want to keep peace with everybody. Let's not fight. Let's not have any kind of disagreement at all. To the lack of loyalty to Jesus. Don't be like the Jewish leaders who refuse to admit, you know, I was wrong and I need to change. Instead, we all want to be like this blind man. Loyal to Jesus. Willing to suffer with him, even when it is not popular. We're going to sing a song now.